The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Today's world news, what it means, where it's taking us.
I bring you the one and only possible message of world peace.
This is a message of hope, tremendous hope. And he said unto me, you must prophesy again.
The Trumpet Daily Program begins right now.
Hello and welcome to the Trumpet Daily Radio Show. This is Richard Palmer, guest hosting this morning, or this afternoon it is now for us, for Mr. Stephen Flurry. You're listening to KPCG on 101.3 on the FM dial. It's another absolutely beautiful day here at Edstone. Blue sky, wonderfully warm weather. A couple of days ago the temperature reached the 90s. Today it's a very pleasant mid-80s. Of course, we're not used to this hot weather, so it does cause some problems, though I think we Brits lose the right to complain about heat because we're always complaining about cold and wet so much. And it also sounds a little ridiculous complaining about the heat being in the mid-80s when you're on a radio station going out in central Oklahoma. But as I said, the hot weather does cause some problems. British Telecom, the national embarrassment that runs much of our phone and internet infrastructure over here, they've been having some major problems, possibly related to the heat. Some of those exchanges have been going down, so the phones have been a bit iffy here for us at Edstone this morning. If you've been trying to get through, sorry about that. It should be working now, though. We've messaged us to say everything is fixed. Well, I wanted to start today talking about France's reaction to the Nice attacks. It's something about I spoke a bit about with Mr. Hilliker on Trumpet Hour yesterday. But there are some important points to be made here. It's something that he and I were talking about a bit further, even after the interview, and something I did want to look into further. And so, there's a lot of very interesting, very important material for us to get into into how France, how all of Europe is responding to these terrorist attacks. Now, after the attack on Charlie Hebdo in January, and then again after those November attacks at the Bataclan and other places in Paris, the majority of Frenchmen approved of French President François Hollande's reaction. They said they believed he was doing a good job of responding to terrorist threats. But in the aftermath of Nice, it's very, very different. Two-thirds, I think that was a poll published on Monday, said that they do not trust the government to fight terrorism. And when French President Manuel Valls attended a minute's silence in Nice, here's how he was received by the crowd. That's quite the reaction, and it went on a bit longer. That's not just one or two people booing him. That's a whole crowd there in Nice booing their Prime Minister when he comes to have a minute's silence for those victims. The people there, they were shouting, "Murderer! Murderer!" I think the main chant was, "Resign! Resign!" So there's a lot of anger in France now directed not just against the terrorists, against the government as well. I titled the article I wrote on Friday, immediately after that attack, Nice Attacks, We Must Learn to Live with Terrorism, based on a quote from that French Prime Minister, Manuel Valls. And then on Sunday, he gave an interview that was published on that Sunday, where he said, there will be more attacks. This is difficult to say, but other lives will be lost. Terrorism will be a part of our daily lives for a long time. That's not what you want to hear immediately after a terrorist attack. Terrorism is going to be a part of our daily lives, for a long time. And you can see why people in France are angry with a national leader who responds to a terrorist attack in that way. And we talked about three terrorist attacks in Paris in 18 months. When we say that, we're just talking about the big ones. There is just a regular low-level violence. Here's just one news story. I think this was yesterday or the day before. where there was a French woman and her three young daughters were seriously wounded in a knife attack at an alpine resort. And yes, that was on Tuesday. That was after those Nice attacks, after the teenager with an axe went on a rampage on a coach in Germany. And so this article says that the youngest girl was rushed to hospital with a punctured lung after being stabbed by this man named Mohammed. There's reports, or that it says the French television channel says that he may have acted out of religious motives. The French prosecutor said that he was not angry about the girls wearing shorts, but the French television channel TF1, they've said no, the government, the French prosecutor is wrong about that. He was angry because the girls were wearing shorts. He may have had religious motives, and so he stabbed an 8-year-old girl and her mother and her sister, 12 and 14. Now their injuries, it says they were serious, not life threatening, not as bad as the injuries to this 8-year-old girl. But that is what Manuel Valls is saying France is going to have to live with. And I mean, to be fair to him, in a lot of ways he is right in that there aren't easy ways of solving this. There's no magic button the French president can press. It means big changes to French society. It means big changes to the way that France treats Muslims, changes that he does not want to make. But you can see if French people are being told, well, you're just going to have to put up with it. We're just going to have to live with a man driving a bus into 80 families enjoying a fireworks display. We're just going to have to live with these regular reports of somebody stabbing an 8-year-old girl. We're just going to have to live with that. You can see why they're angry. And just to finish off this news article, it said he stabbed the girls while they ate breakfast on the terrace of their chalet and went inside and knifed their mother. And I think, if I remember correctly, this was at a holiday resort. An alpine resort. This was their summer holidays. And we're just seeing these kind of tragic stories commonly. And those stories are tragic, but it is having an impact on France. It is having an impact on Europe. The polling agency that conducted this poll that found that two-thirds disagree or did not trust the government to handle terrorism, IFOP, somebody from there had some quote. He said from the polling agency IFOP, he said that voters want someone that they feel is in charge at the top. In those moments, like the moments of the Nice attack, they want a commander in chief. And they don't see François Hollande. They don't see Manuel Valls. The Germans don't see Angela Merkel. Now, they haven't had a major attack like France yet, but it's clear they don't see her that way. They don't see her that as a commander-in-chief, as someone who's really in control. François Hollande, just the same day of those attacks, said, we're winning the war against terrorism, so we're going to end the state of emergencies. And just the same day, there's another terrorist attack. The state of emergency has been extended not 3 months now, at least according to Parliament's recommendation, but 6 months. But that sentence, lowering the state of emergency on the same day of that killing, and that shows that he's not in control. He doesn't know what's going on. And that's having an impact on the French people. Here's a quote from someone living in Nice. We are getting more and more racist, but unfortunately, we need to. I don't know how much of that is lost in translation from French. I think it's quite hard to imagine someone actually saying that, putting it that bluntly. But there's a lot of desperation. It's bringing out a lot of change, a lot of turmoil in France, and the feelings are running very high in Nice. The locals, they erected a kind of memorial on the spot where this terrorist who drove the bus was shot. They marked it with stones, and then they put all kinds of rubbish on top of it. People spat on it. Someone urinated on that spot while the crowd cheered. So there's a lot of anger, a lot of emotion. Of course people are angry. 80 are dead. That's a huge number for just one guy in a truck. I was in Jerusalem during the bulldozer attack. I think that was in 2008, where they in the first attack they drove. I guess it was mainly reported as a bulldozer. It was more of a digger, and someone drove that. They killed three people, I think. Yeah, three people. And before then, I'd kind of taken a more, I guess, a rather mathematical view of terrorist attacks. You think, four people dead, that's not too big a deal. It is sad, obviously, but surely more people than that just die in car accidents in a big city on any given day. But being there showed me the effect is very different. It does affect the whole city in a way that deaths by car accidents don't. I mean, everywhere you walk and drive after that, I did this. Everyone I knew did this. You'd kind of notice where the yellow diggers were, the bulldozers, and keep half an eye on them. There's a sense that the whole city is on edge, and that's in Jerusalem, a city that's used to terrorist attacks like just about no other city on earth. And that's a terrorist attack that killed three people. Nice, 80 people. Hundreds injured. Of course, that's going to have a major, major effect on Nice. On more. And on all of France. The Daily Beast, they had an article over the last couple of days. They wrote, "What sets Buchlels, that was the terrorists' violence, apart is the scale of the carnage and also the political and social environment of the moment. Buchlels' action has resonance outside of his own sordid life," says influential French criminologist Alan Bauer, "because it feeds many different kinds of anger in contemporary society. It is pure rage wrapped in the times. Potentially," this article continues, "potentially the most frightening part of Buchlels' grotesque checkout from the land of the living is that his attack came at a moment where France and Europe are so divided and the political atmosphere so fraught that even the insane act of a lowlife trying to purge his personal demons with the blood of innocence could have cataclysmic consequences." Cataclysmic consequences. And then, other news sources, they've made the point, I've seen this in a few different places, that up until now, the big terrorist attacks in France, they'd all been in Paris. Or they'd been targeting like the media, like that Charlie Hebdo attack, or they'd been targeting Jews, and we've seen the number of Jews leaving France increase dramatically as they become the subject of many of these attacks. But then these attacks on Nice, they're outside of Paris, they're against ordinary people. I think it was in our news yesterday that a third of those dead even were Muslim. And so, well, one analyst, they said, all of France feels directly threatened. He spoke about how this has struck a broader chord, because it's clear this is a problem for the whole nation. It's not just a problem for Paris. It's not just a danger with Paris or a danger if you're a Jew. It's a danger for everybody. Now, the head of France's General Directorate of Internal Security, Patrick Calva, he has had some very dramatic statements. These were before the Nice attacks. He gave a closed-door session with a parliamentary committee. Some of those were published. Other statements have been leaked out to the press. This is the equivalent, basically, of the head of the FBI or the head of MI5. So a very senior, respected figure in France. And he said, "We are on the verge of a civil war. That's how great the pressures on French society are. We are on the verge of civil war. If there are one or two more attacks," he warned, "then," he said, "that there would be a confrontation between France's ultra-right." He said a major confrontation between France's ultra-right is going to take place. He talked about how society is at a tipping point. And there's the problem with Muslim extremists. And then he also talked about the anti-immigrant extremists on the Muslim right. And he said, "You'll have a confrontation between the extreme right and the Muslim world. Not the Islamists, but actually the Muslim world. Europe is in great danger," he said. Extremism is rising all over, and we, the internal security services, are in the process of redeploying resources to focus on the ultra-right that is waiting for nothing but confrontation. You will recall that I always try to use direct language, he said. Well, so I believe this confrontation is going to take place. If there's one or two more attacks, this is going to happen. And he's not the only person making these kind of statements. Jonathan Miller, he's a councillor in southern France, and he wrote an op-ed for CNBC, and he talked about civil war as well. He said, I wish I could say this was just hysterical exaggeration, but the evidence does not support complacency. He was talking about this being the worst, the most dangerous time for French democracy since 1939. He talked about how membership at a local gun club near him, membership had quadrupled. They're getting ready for war, a local farmer told him. Now, too often these kind of authorities, they do seem more worried about how people will react to Muslim attacks than stopping the attacks themselves. And so I think these statements, they probably do show some liberal bias from these type of people. But there is great cause for instability here, great reason to be concerned. I don't like to call the fringe groups in Europe far right. It seems I'd prefer to refer to as fringe right or fringe parties. Some of them I think get characterized as far right in the media, and they're not really what I would call far right. They're very different from the Nazis or from the fascists in Italy. But in terms of those kind of fringe right groups, the French National Front, they're definitely furthest out there. They're also, in a lot of ways, could better be described as far left in terms of their economic policies. But they do have this fringe party, this party that has a strong history of things like anti-Semitism. Now, they've been trying to clean that up in recent years. How much of that is cosmetic and how much of that is actually genuine, I don't know. But they are the one of the top groups out there. And actually, though, a few analysts have pointed out their presence may be keeping the lid on a lot of what's happening in France, stopping any violence from boiling over. At the moment, the polls, and for months, the polls have shown that when it comes to France's next presidential election, Marine Le Pen, the far right, the fringe right, the Front National candidate, will come in first place. But the way the French presidential elections work is there's then a second round of voting where the first place candidate and the second place candidate face off. And so, you know, a lot of people are putting their hope, I think a lot of those people who might be far right within France, they're putting their hope in Marine Le Pen and in the Front National winning the presidency, winning the election. One analyst here, Bauer, don't have his first name noted down, but he said we have extreme right groups that are active, but they're waiting for Le Pen to win the election. Now, and this article concludes, I'm afraid I didn't note down where it's from, but it concludes, if jihadist terrorism continues, as it certainly will, I think it's from The Spectator, and Marine Le Pen loses her bid for the presidency, as she probably will, then all bets are off. So if Marine Le Pen, she wins the first round, then gets defeated in the second round, which is quite likely, as then both the left and right of the mainstream parties in France unite against her. I think it's also very possible that she could win, but it's also it's possible that she could then lose that second round. Then all bets are off. Then all of these people that have been training for war, then they may decide, well, now's the time that we need war. Now's the time that we need to take action. We can't. Marine Le Pen's not going to be able to win this through democracy. We need to put in a strong leader ourselves. And you've got so many people making these same warnings. Just to go to another one, Wall Street Journal, and they're talking again about Calva, the head of internal security in France, that equivalent of the director of the FBI. They asked if his statements were excessive. They said, look at the Salafists, an estimated 15,000 among France's 5 to 7 million Muslims whose radical fundamentalist creed dominates many of the predominantly Muslim housing projects at the edges of cities such as Paris, Nice, or Lyon. Their preachers call for a civil war, with all Muslims tasked to wipe out the miscreants down the street. At the same time, the right-wing extremists singled out by Mr. Calver would be ideologically capable of shooting any Muslims. And a bit further on, they write, the Nice attack contains a unique point of agreement. It represents the end of an epoch and the start of one in which France must come to terms with the near certainty of new tragedy and new Britain, new victims. Socialist President François Hollande was quoted as saying over the weekend as that never since World War II have democracies been so threatened. It's reasonable today to add that France hasn't appeared this dysfunctional and politically riven since 1939. So France is going through all of these terrorist attacks, and it's causing a major political crisis, the worst since 1939. The Spectator made a similar point. The problem is that politicians in France, and even more so in Germany, have been refusing to address these facts about radical Islam, about Muslims, about immigration, and radical Muslims coming in with these immigrants. They've been refusing to address these facts for too long and are often rightly held responsible for allowing this situation to emerge. It's not as though nobody warned the French and German governments of the repercussions of allowing millions of people into their countries unvetted. The problem is that everyone who warned about it was called racist and told to shut up. The publics are increasingly losing confidence in the ability of this political class to protect them. They're losing confidence in the ability of this political class. It's not just a party. It's not just François Hollande. It's not just Manuel Valls. It's not just Angela Merkel. They're losing confidence in the ability of this political class to protect them. And so the politics, which have been kept to the margins, is becoming tolerable to the mainstream. I have said for over a decade that if mainstream politicians don't address this issue, then they would leave it to Marine Le Pen. And so they have. I'll read one more quote from just another article in The Spectator recently over the past week or two. And they warned, that terrorism, this terrorist threat across Western Europe has been high for some time now and is unlikely to go away anytime soon. This is from Ed West in The Spectator. Personally, I'm not sure liberal democracies can survive the existence of even a small minority out to destroy them. So this will be a challenge, as The Economist might put it. So Europe is in a very dangerous, France, all of Europe, position right now. One senior member of, or analyst, they talked about, they said that the Islamic State, they are trying to understand where to poke them. They're trying to understand where they can poke Europe, to provoke Europe, to provoke a radical response, an attack, a response against all Muslims. So this is the crisis that we are in. We'll take a short break. And when we come back, we'll talk about where all this is leading.
This is KPCG-FM, and this is The Trumpet Daily.
Herbert W. Armstrong long forecast the arrival of a military superpower in Europe. In a world where European nations can't rely on the United States, one in which they fear Russia and face the constant threat of radical terror, their only hope of survival is to band together. This is what we see happening, and what we see happening was prophesied in your Bible. Request Germany and the Holy Roman Empire to learn about the history of Germany and the Holy Roman Empire and to understand where the events in Europe today are leading. 3,000 years ago, the prophet Daniel explained that at the time of the end, radical Islam would push against Europe. That time is now. We are witnessing the first manifestations of this Islamist push against Europe. and it's leading to a spectacular clash between these two prophesied kings, the King of the North and the King of the South. What does the Bible say about the identity of these two kings? What about the end time? Will everyone be affected by these events? Request our two booklets, The King of the South and Germany and the Holy Roman Empire. To learn more, please visit thetrumpet.com.
The Trumpet Daily.
Hello and welcome back to the Trumpet Daily radio show. This is Richard Palmer, guest hosting for Mr. Stephen Flurry. You're listening to KPCG, available online at kpcg.fm, where you can also listen to all of our past programs, and on 101.3 on the FM dial in Edmond, Oklahoma. We've been talking about just the dramatic response and the dramatic dangers in France after the terrorist attack, about François Hollande saying that never since World War II have democracies been so threatened, talking about that France hasn't appeared this dysfunctional and politically riven since 1939. So where do we go from here, though? What's coming next? Mr. Hilliker and I talked about this a little yesterday. A dictator, a strong man. This is what people crave in times of trouble, and this is what we see time and time again. You can take a huge sweep of history and see this so often. It was the case in ancient Greece in times of crisis. The ancient Greek city-states would often be taken over. The city-state would be taken over by a tyrant. Now, crisis wasn't the only reason for a tyrant to be put in charge or for the people to want a tyrant, but it was a common one. The Roman Republic, they actually built this into their political system. In times of crisis, then Rome would appoint a dictator. And that was pretty much his job title, dictator. And the dictator, he would have almost unlimited powers. Now, crucially, his powers would have a clear expiry date. There would be a very specific crisis that he was appointed to deal with, and then that was done. He would lose those powers, he would step down. Often he was also set kind of a strict expiry date, like 6 months. They tried to keep them short so that the dictator couldn't cement himself too firmly into that role. But you saw this very often. But then in antiquity, there was a second major reason that you would see a tyrant come on the scene. And that's also very relevant, very interesting to what we see today. And this was when the masses of the people, the poor people, felt that they had no power. Often they would put their hopes in a tyrant to go in there and to smash the political spectrum system, to make life better for them. Encyclopedia Britannica, talking about tyranny in ancient Greece, they write, in the early stages of the Greek polis, or city-state, the hereditary aristocracy had all political power and ruled as a group, with the masses of citizens excluded from political life. And then they talked about how many historians believe that tyrants were representative of a newly politically conscious demos, or people who supported the rise of tyrants in the hopes of improving their position within the state. And they write that it is true that early tyrants tended to have popular support. They give some examples, and that they who offered an alternative to exploitation by aristocrats, and certain tyrants introduced reforms intended to please the demos, the people, codifying the laws, establishing justice. And then, much later in the same article, or the same encyclopedia entry, they write, in ancient times, tyrants tended to be popular because the people saw them as upholding their interests. Tyrants often introduced measures to improve the economic and social status of the poor. It was the aristocracy who wrote the histories who tended to oppose tyranny because in bypassing the constitution, tyrants threatened their traditional privileges. And you saw the same kind of thing in ancient Rome. Publius Clodius Pulcher, he rallied the people behind him in a similar way. And Project Syndicate had an article on him a couple of months ago, likening and bringing out some trends, some similarities between him and some modern politics, as we'll get into a moment. And he was a member of the wealthy elite, but he promised to make things much better for the masses, for the mob in Rome. And so they rallied behind him, and he was rapidly ascending in power, so the elites had him killed. And so at this point, the masses, many of the masses, they turned their allegiance to someone new, an incredibly successful general known as Julius Caesar. And today we see the same kind of pressures. You know, across the world, people see chaos like we were talking about in France. But there's also a widespread belief now that people don't control their country anymore. That the dice is stacked against ordinary people, the demos, the plebeians. A widespread belief that their country is controlled by a small set of elite, and that the masses are barred from power. And so people are willing to put their trust in a tyrant, to, just like in ancient Greece or Rome, go in and smash all the rules and break the system so that it can work for them again. And perhaps America is the clearest example of this. You know, on the left, you see things like the Black Lives Matter movement that do not like the Constitution, to put it mildly. They don't necessarily have a key figurehead right now. But that whole swathe of movement, you could see they would support a tyrant if they came in and promised to fix the problems that they believe America has. But you see this outside the far left as well. You see this with the rise of Donald Trump. You know, people feel disenfranchised, they feel let down, they feel like their voice doesn't matter, that politics in Washington is controlled by elites. And so just like in antiquity, they're putting their trust in one man, someone with a strong personality, just like some of those tyrants of old, especially Claudius in Rome. A strong personality to go in and fix it for them. And so last night, when Ted Cruz got up there and spoke about the importance of supporting a candidate that upheld the Constitution at the Republican National Convention, he was booed. And now they weren't booing him because they disliked the Constitution, but they booed him because everyone understood that this was a veiled attack on Donald Trump. It's just well known and accepted that Donald Trump isn't the presidential candidate with the most fidelity to the Constitution, if I could put it that way. And to many of his supporters, the man, the personality, getting Donald Trump in there, that's more important than the Constitution. And so when Ted Cruz is up there talking about the importance of supporting candidates that believe in the Constitution, he's booed. But this trend of people wanting tyrants in times of crisis, it continued well beyond Rome, just to get back to that particular cause of the rise in tyrants. And Rome was so opposed to, or the Roman Senate, those at the top, the elites you could call them, they were so opposed to a dictator that they killed Caesar. But then the empire descended into civil war. Caesar's adopted son, Octavius, eventually emerged victorious and was accepted as emperor himself, where Caesar, when trying to become emperor, had been killed. Octavius, of course, who became known as Augustus Caesar, went on to found, or almost refound, Rome as an empire. And why was he able to do that when Caesar had been killed for trying to do the same thing? Julius Caesar had been killed for trying to do the same thing? Because after crisis, after all that destructive civil war, people wanted peace. People wanted a strong man in charge. It didn't matter so much all those Republican ideals that they had had before that civil war had been started with the death of Caesar. Now, especially in the case of Augustus Caesar, that's not the only reason. He had absolutely incredible political skill, was probably one of the most, the greatest politicians, if you mean in terms of ability at doing politics. He was one of the greatest practitioners of that probably in all of history. It was not simply a default desire for a tyrant, but he was able to get accepted as a strong man because people wanted a strong man after that all that turmoil. And you saw the same, we see exactly the same thing after Europe begins experimenting with democracy, and even beyond Europe. It just occurred to me now, I didn't really look into things like Simon Bolivar in Latin America too much, but I'm sure there are similar trends there. And when I was talking with Mr. Hillicker yesterday, we were talking about the French Revolution. seeing as that the Nice attack had occurred on Bastille Day, the anniversary of the storming of the Bastille that really got a lot of things started in that revolution. And that whole period of history is an absolutely fascinating one, with so many just ideas of government being tossed around and experimented with and tried, and people toying with ideals that went on to basically be communism or fascism and democracy, all kind of within such a short space of time. But the people got rid of the king in 1793, but the nation was facing crisis. People were still revolting. The new leadership wasn't really working. France was at war and not doing all that well. Food was hard to come by. And so those that had overthrown the king, they decided they needed strong leadership. And so they created the infamous Committee of Public Safety and gave it huge power. And then, of course, the man who rose to the top then to become just about all-powerful dictator was Maximilien Robespierre. And there's this strong leader that people craved after the time of crisis. He unleashed the reign of terror. And this is where the word terrorism first began to be used in the English language, with what Robespierre did. It was a precursor of things like the gulags of Stalin's Russia. During the reign of terror, at least 300,000 suspects were arrested. 17,000 were officially executed. Perhaps 10,000 died in prison or without trial. And this was in under a year. Now, Robespierre's downfall was that he was too brutal. He was an idealist. He believed, he had a strong certainty that he was right. It didn't matter to him how many people he killed. And to other top politicians in France, it became clear, you know, if we don't do something about this guy, he's going to kill us sooner or later. If we rebel and we lose, we'll be killed. But if we stick around, we're certainly going to die as well. And so there was a coup. The Thermidor coup, they rebelled, and just under a year later, of becoming this almost all-powerful dictator, Robespierre himself was guillotined. But then France went back to the other extreme. So they'd just witnessed what a strong man could do. Nobody wanted to repeat that, so instead they created a government with so many checks and balances that it was completely ineffective. The result was more turmoil, hyperinflation, military defeat, and so once again people longed for a strong man. I'll just quote from Andrew Roberts's book Napoleon the Great, and he talks about the Brumaire coup, in which Napoleon took over France, or at this point it was Napoleon and cohorts. He very quickly engineered things so that he became first consul and essentially dictator. But he, talking about this time, he writes, "Why wasn't even so much as a penknife pulled in defense of the French constitution? If not at Saint-Cloud, then at least back in Paris. If either the Directory or the 500, these are the ineffective instruments of the old regime, if they had had any popular support at all, there would have been barricades in Paris that night and in other major French cities once the news reached them. But in fact, not one was raised, nor a shot fired in their defence. The working class arrondissements, such as the..." Anyway, it goes on to talk about a few different working class groups. "They had no love of the Directory and failed to rise." He writes, "After a decade of revolution, many Frenchmen were desperate. Desperate for leadership, and recognised that the parliamentary process inhibited that, as did a constitution that was next to impossible to amend. They were thus willing to see representative government temporarily suspended in order for Napoleon and his co-conspirators to cut the Gordian knot. Certainly, public opinion in Paris was indifferent to whether Napoleon had used force or not to gain power. Army officers prize order, discipline, and efficiency, each of which Napoleon considered by then to be more important than liberty, equality, and fraternity, and at that moment the French people agreed with him." That's what happens in times of crisis. People prize order, discipline, efficiency. They value safety, protection. We like liberty, fraternity, equality when times are good. And really those kind of values of the French Enlightenment, there are some differences between the kind of the English Anglo-Saxon way of thinking on liberty, but we'll save that for some other time. But if our lives are on the line, you know, it's life, it's order, it's protection that's more important. One of the most important examples of this comes around 150 years earlier, before the French Revolution. Most important because from this conflict came the man who would perhaps most clearly articulate the forces behind this desire for a strong man. And that was the English Civil War. From 1642 to 1651, all this is the English, it's called the English Civil War, but really the entire UK was, and Ireland, the entire British Isles was engulfed in a series of civil wars. The king was executed in 1649, but again, the result of all of this turmoil was that England turned to a dictator, Oliver Cromwell. Cromwell was in a lot of ways like Napoleon, a brilliant military commander who came up with a new way of organizing the army, which then made the army absolutely dominant. I think Paul Johnson, in his book on the Offshore Islanders, talks about how if Cromwell had wanted, he could have marched up and down Europe just like Napoleon did. And then he took political power, turned himself into a dictator. Now, unlike Napoleon, he never took the crown. But you see the same thing. England began by rebelling against a king, just like the French Revolution. The king that they felt had too much power, but in the chaos that followed, they decided, you know, actually, we need a strong man. And so, again, you have a revolution against someone who accused of having too much power. It ends up with the creation of a strong man, the creation of a dictator, because when people see all that disorder, they want a strong man. And watching all this in the Civil War was Thomas Hobbes, and in 1651, at the end of the war, he wrote Leviathan, you know, one of the most famous books on government ever written. And The Natural State of Man was the war of all against all, he wrote. And he talked about how people are divided. They can't agree among themselves what is good, and the only way to stop all this division, all this fighting, is strong government. So people need to give up power to a Leviathan. A strong man, someone who can keep order. Now, that's a bit of a simplistic summary of Hobbes's book. But it is exactly what we see now, exactly what we see building in France, in all of Europe. Now, everybody can see the increased uncertainty in today's world. The worse things get, the more people are going to crave a strong man. The louder those calls are going to be. But all of this history, that shows us, when you see people talking about the worst crisis in French government since 1939, when you see people saying there could be civil war in France, when people are saying, I don't know whether democracy can survive this kind of thing, this is what's next, a strong man, a tyrant. In 1969, in The Plain Truth, Mr. Armstrong, he wrote, the world appears bereft of great men, but a world-recognized strong man in all probability will now appear very soon. There will be 10, ruling 10 nations or groups of nations in the once great Holy Roman Empire, but there will be one super king over the 10. Mr. Armstrong wrote, all Europe is waiting for the confidence-inspiring leader. This quote's from 1959. A confidence-inspiring leader. And it's on his way. That man is out there somewhere. And we see this already happening beyond Europe's borders. We see this Vladimir Putin in Russia. The country's falling apart. The country was falling apart, I should say, in the 1990s. Things under Yeltsin were getting pretty bad. So they brought in a strong man. We see the same kind of thing in Turkey. And we saw very recently, a couple of weeks ago, the Turkish president, Recep Tayyip Erdogan, he did not look very popular. People were protesting against him in the streets. And I think in a lot of ways there are a lot of what he's still quite unpopular in Turkey. But when faced with the possibility of a military coup, with all of the uncertainty that brings, in 1980 there was a military coup, 650,000 were arrested, 200,000 imprisoned, 7,000 put to death. 7,000 people put to death. You know, so when people are faced with all that, the possibility of that, well, then they came out in support on the streets in favor of the man who is cracking down on free speech, who is threatening to turn the nation into some kind of Islamic dictatorship. They'd rather the strongman Erdogan, as unpopular as he might have been, and maybe he wasn't as unpopular as it looked from the pro-West or the coverage from the West that tends to focus on the young and those that speak English and live in the towns. But anyway, faced with that uncertainty, they come out, they would much rather the strong man. And so we're going to see exactly the same thing in Europe. You're going to see people looking for more powers. I mean, we see this already with the emergency powers in France. And as things get worse, the people will say, well, we need to give more powers to the government, more powers to the president, more powers to the one inside. We need a strong leader. But the trouble with starting to give more and more powers to the strong leader, to the strong man, Hobbes himself very insightfully pointed out what tends to happen there. He wrote that, in the first place I put forth a general inclination of all mankind, a perpetual and restless desire of power after power that ceases only in death. Man, seeks power after power, wrote Hobbes, and he's right. And he writes, and the cause of this is not always that a man hopes for more intensive delight that he can that he has already attained to, or that he cannot be content with a moderate power, but because he cannot assure the power and means to live well which he hath present without the acquisition of more. And hence it is that kings whose power is greatest turn their endeavour to the assuring of it at home by laws or abroad by wars. And so his point is, in that slightly archaic English, that you give someone moderate power and they immediately have to use that moderate power to set about gaining more power, because otherwise they can't be assured that they're going to be able to keep and enjoy the moderate amount of power that they have. So if Europe, they start to set up, say, a quote-unquote moderate strongman, that man will use that moderate power that he has to gain more and more. And so that's what we see throughout history, where people, in times of crisis, they may try to put in charge someone with more moderate powers, but then it very quickly snowballs. Now, Caesar was a general, then he was a leading member of the first triumvirate, three men that shared power in Rome, and then became a dictator and went for emperor. Cromwell ruled with parliament before getting rid of it. Napoleon started out as first consul before then getting rid of more and more checks on his powers as time went on before becoming emperor. That's where Europe is leading. A strong man. And then once you appoint a strong man, they just accrue more and more power. Well, that took up more time than I was expecting. There were a couple of other news stories I'd want to bring to your attention. I'll just go over those quickly before we close. One comes from the Republican Convention in Dallas. And Donald Trump, ahead of his, I think he's got a fairly big speech today, or something like that, tonight, he spoke to the New York Times, and he gave an interview to give a preview of what he'd be talking about. And he said that the theme would be America First, which is a very... America First was the movement in World War II that wanted to keep America out of the war, Actually, if you want the best critique of America first, look at Dr. Seuss's cartoons in the run-up to World War II. He had some excellent cartoons just lambasting the America First movement there for being okay to... It was the belief, as Churchill put it, that if you feed the crocodile will eat you last. The America First movement wanted to keep America out of the war, which would then, of course, led to Hitler rising to the point that he could have actually threatened the United States. Now, I don't know whether Donald Trump... I'm guessing his use of the America First slogan is more of a coincidence than him trying to deliberately hearken back to that movement. But anyway, the main thing this New York Times article drew attention to, and the headline was, Donald Trump sets conditions for defending NATO allies against attack. And he said... writing in this New York Times piece, or the New York Times, he even called into question whether, as president, he would automatically extend the security guarantees that give the 28 members of NATO the assurance that the full force of the United States military has their back. For example, asked about Russia's threatening activities that have unnerved the small Baltic states that are among the more recent entrants into NATO, Mr. Trump said that if Russia attacks them, he would decide whether or not to come to their aid only after reviewing whether those nations have fulfilled their obligations to us. He added, if they fulfill their obligations to us, the answer is yes. Now, I spoke about this on a program a few months ago from Donald Trump's earlier comments from NATO, but this is going to have a major, major impact on Europe. Now, these nations in Europe, they rely on American protection. And Donald Trump is saying, well, we might not protect you. It's conditional. You do what the United States wants, then we'll protect you. And that's really going to push Europe to work on its own military force, on its own army, to push to its own kind of European version of NATO. Now, I do sympathize a lot with what Mr. Trump is saying. America has spent a huge amount of money to keep Europe safe, and Europe takes so much of that for granted. And I'm sure America could have set up a better, fairer system. But we also need to point out what the consequences of what Mr. Trump is saying will be. And even if Donald Trump is not the next president, these comments, they're still going to push Europe to rearm. It will push Europe to form its own defense union, because that's the only way they can really defend themselves. Push Europe to become a separate power, a rival power. And so it's really going to push Europe to unite militarily, just like Mr. Armstrong talked about. Finally, there's one other story I'll just mention very, very quickly, because I'm rapidly running out of time. This is an article from the Times of London. Police braced for repeat of 2011 London riots. Police launched extra patrols across London last night and cancelled officers' leaves among fears of further rioting and stabbings after a spate of violent incidents involving thousands of people. One police officer was stabbed and four more injured at Hyde Park on Tuesday in the worst outbreak of youth violence since the August 2011 riots. So there was this was the hottest day of the year. There was kind of just a fun water fight in this park in the middle of London. But then it got late, and so the police came along. I think they kind of said, all right, time to go. And it said it escalated into clashes between police and thousands of revelers, leaving the banks of the Serpentine resembling a, quote, war zone. And it talked about bottles and firecrackers being thrown at police. Now, the other part to watch here, there is a racial component to that. One park reveler said, look at the amount of black people there. Think about it. If it was the other way around with white people playing music, it wouldn't have happened. And some were saying that the disturbances had to do with Black Lives Matter. The police said that they denied that. But it would be interesting to see now. The police are worried about more tension. I was going to just remind you of what went on in August 2011, where the police just lost control of huge areas of London, where people just ran in there and looted. Now, that began as a racial process where the police shot a black man and they started to become these protests. I think very quickly it just became an excuse young men of all races, especially there were black and there were a large number of white youth going in there and just looting shops. but there will be keep a close eye on not only that tension and that potential for violence in the US. Definitely keep an eye on that, but also in the UK. Well, that's about all that I've got time for. We're quickly coming to the end of the show. Now, if you some bleak subjects today. If you want to listen to some the important, the vital hope behind all of these subjects, go back and listen to Mr. Stephen Flurry's program from yesterday. That's about it from me, though. I believe Mr. Stephen Flurry will be back tomorrow, so tune in next time on KPCG on 101.3 on the FM dial and at kpcg.fm.